SIS 206, summer session. This is lecture 4, which is more about dualist description. And in particular, what I want to talk about today, since last time we talked quite a bit about qualitative description, which is to say description that doesn't necessarily utilize numbers. Today I want to talk a little bit about quantitative description, which, as you could probably guess, is description that uses numbers in order to describe things. So, what exactly is quantitative description beyond simply that notion of using numbers? Well, methodologically, quantitative description is very much like any other form of description. The fact that it uses numbers marks a technical difference between quantitative description and qualitative or non-quantitative description. But in essence, in philosophical and methodological commitment, describing something with numbers is very much like describing something with words. You still have variables. They're still just as clearly defined as they were when we were talking about qualitative description. So you still actually need to go through that same kind of process about what the variable is and why the variable is there. The goal, just like in doing qualitative description, is to code your cases accurately, to get accurate measurements of each particular variable on the value of particular variables in particular cases, right? So that's basically still what you're trying to do. The fact that you're using numbers just makes it look different in a lot of ways. There are benefits and drawbacks to the use of numbers. Benefits and drawbacks. Right? So it's not always the case that you should necessarily reach for numerical descriptions when you're doing social scientific research. There are some cases in which it's a really good idea. There are other cases in which it's probably not worth it. So what are the benefits? Why and under what circumstances would you actually want to quantify and use numbers to actually engage in your descriptive research? What are the benefits of doing so? Well, the primary benefit is, of course, precision. A number is much more precise, much more exact than a verbal description in a lot of cases. As long as you've clearly specified what your measurement criteria are supposed to be, numbers can be very, 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 very precise and allow you to hone in on exactly what's going on in some particular case with respect to some particular variable. Numbers allow you to capture relationships, in particular, between different phenomena very, very precisely. The use of numbers allows you to have very, very fine-grained ways of talking about how something changes across particular cases. So you can be much more exacting about this than you can if you're just using verbal depictions. And of course, whenever you're using numbers, you're producing a continuous scale of values. Remember our discussion last time when I was talking about different kinds of measurement of variables. Any use of numbers is going to give you a continuous scale. And so that's going to allow you to do rank ordering of various types. So everything that uses numbers is automatically going to put you over in that side of the variable measurement question that we were talking about. You'll always have continuity. You'll always have the ability to rank order. This, of course, means you can have very refined and very precise strategies of comparison. One of the points that I was making last time was that any description is inherently comparative to the extent that you have articulated explicitly what the standards are by which you're coding some factor in a particular case. As soon as you've done that, you make it possible to code other cases according to those same criteria. That means that any discussion, any descriptive discussion of one particular instance is at least implicitly making reference to other things. Now, when you're just using words, it's sometimes harder to actually do those comparisons because you don't have a nice rank ordering that you can utilize. You can have very, very refined strategies of comparison when you're using numbers. There's actually quite a bit of fairly complicated mathematics that could be utilized. We won't be doing any of that here because this is not an advanced quantitative statistics class, but the fact that there are such things as advanced quantitative statistics classes should indicate to you that there are, in fact, more realms to explore in terms of doing this kind of stuff if that's the direction you really wanted to go with your particular project. The other benefit of using numbers is it allows you to really expand the number of cases you're dealing with simultaneously. When you are doing qualitative description, it's really hard to know more than a handful of cases in sufficient detail to be able to figure out what the values of the particular variables are in those cases. And it's next to impossible to actually manipulate that information and do anything with it. Even if you could accurately describe 8 cases or something, by the time you got through the description of 8 cases, you would be basically done. There'd be no more space in your research project and no more time for you to be able to do these things. Using numbers, on the other hand, because you have a much more fine-grained way of coding particular variables, you can use many, many, many more cases very, very easily. And because of this, you can end up producing results that are potentially much more generalizable. In other words, results from your description, which if you can sort of describe a systematic relationship between a couple of different kinds of factors in different cases, that might actually generalize to other cases, right? Because you have a much broader base from which to draw to make your particular contention and then make it stick. So that is often held out as one of the major benefits of using numbers, that you can do a lot more cases a lot more easily. But as I said, there are also drawbacks of making your project quantitative. There are drawbacks of quantifying all of your variable measurements. And one of the primary drawbacks, it turns out, is the same as one of the primary benefits, which is to say, precision. There are some things where the precision of numbers actually misrepresents the concept that you're trying to get across. Numbers are very, very good for discrete kinds of quantities, right? Where you can actually count things, where you can actually put things in a sort of linear fashion. Trying to quantify other things doesn't necessarily work so well. Sometimes numbers give an illusion of exactitude that might not be there. For instance, trying to code quantitatively the way that a particular political ideology is set up might be a little bit misleading, because a quantitative coding of, say, a structure of beliefs that shows up in some political ideology might lead you to over-assume consistency or continuity between different parts of the ideology, between different speakers, and it might actually, in many ways, lead you not just to overestimate the amount of continuity between speakers, but it might actually lead you to downplay the existence of controversy and dissent among the people who adhere to a particular regime's ideology. Maybe they have reservations and such. It's really hard to quantify all of that, because the precision of numbers demand that at a certain point when you're doing the measurement, it either is or it isn't. It's either one thing or another. Right, that's built into the very procedure of counting itself, and it's very difficult to get around that. So precision can be a benefit, but precision, depending on your variable, depending on the concept, depending on what it is you're trying to get at and analyze, might actually be a drawback in some cases. Another one of the drawbacks of using numbers is, again, the flip side of the fact that you can use many more cases much more easily. And that drawback, of course, is that you lose case-specific detail. You learn less about individual cases from reading a quantitative study than you do from reading a qualitative study. Because a qualitative study is going to allow you to immerse yourself in the case more, because the author has had to immerse her or himself in the case more in order to actually be able to code the case on those particular variables. A quantitative study, on the other hand, the focus is much less on the specific details about individual cases. Instead, the focus is on general categories. So we learn quite a bit about the distribution of press freedom across a whole variety of countries if we are using a quantitative description of freedom of the press in the modern world. We don't, however, learn as much about individual countries and how the press works within them, and how press freedom is implemented or threatened or utilized within a particular case. Right, and that's by design. The focus when you're using numbers is very explicitly on these general categories, not on their particular specific instances. So you don't learn as much about particular cases. There is also a problem, a possible problem, using numbers, a risk of what is called a hasty generalization, which is where you take a number of cases, you count up something across them, and then immediately posit that as some kind of universal principle. There are some mathematical procedures for trying to avoid this, but it is very difficult in some cases to avoid the suspicion that whatever generalization you've come up with quantitatively might actually, it's always a suspicion that it might actually be spurious or false or artificial in some ways, because you are dependent when you're doing quantitative work on a whole series of assumptions about the relationship between cases, the relationship between variables, and how the data was collected. And if any of those assumptions are not actually met, it's entirely possible that what your quantitative analysis is actually showing you is not something about the world, but instead just an artifact of the way the data's been collected. Now, one could say, yes, this is also characteristic of smaller n, smaller case qualitative studies. Yes, it can be. But when you're doing smaller number of case qualitative comparative descriptive work, people usually, A, are not really all that interested in generalizing very quickly, so that kind of downplays the risk of that hasty generalization. And it's also a lot, you may not know as much about as many cases if you're doing a small focus study of just a few cases, but you can generally be pretty sure that you know something about them. And you know a few things about the relationship that you're talking about in those particular cases, which means that, other things being equal, there's a lower likelihood. That was kind of awkward. Let me try that again. There is a much lower likelihood in the case of a qualitative small n case comparison that your results are simply artificial. When you're using quantitative studies, you always have to be on the lookout or on guard against the idea, the temptation, the possibility that the work you're getting, the results you're getting, are actually kind of spurious. Now, sometimes even spurious results can be useful. If you've been shopping at Amazon.com lately, you'll notice that when you go and click on a book, you get little recommendations. And the way they do those recommendations is simply by doing massive quantitative data searches through who has ordered a book and what other things have they ordered. And then that pops up as sets of recommendations. And some of the recommendations make sense, and some of the recommendations make absolutely no sense. And you look at it and go, why would people who bought this book have necessarily bought this other strange CD? This doesn't make any sense. Except that empirically, that's what people seem to have bought. So in that sense, statistically speaking, that would be an artificial result. But it is also entirely possible that people looking at that on the screen might go, oh, well, let me go check this thing out, and maybe I'll actually end up buying it. So there's a way that even results that are bad from a social science standpoint might actually be particularly useful in your commercial context. But that's a whole separate question that doesn't necessarily need to bother us right now. All we're interested in, at least for the purposes of this course, is on the social scientific considerations. And these are possible drawbacks of using numbers. That being said, for the rest of today, I want to talk about numbers, and I want to talk about the way in which those numbers are utilized and the way in which you could use them in terms of doing a particular descriptive project. Right? And that's kind of what I want to get at here today. So I'm not going to talk more about benefits and drawbacks of numbers. I'm going to talk more about actual techniques of how you would do this. So hypothetically, suppose you were in fact already determined on doing a quantitative project. How would that work? How do you do quantitative measurement? Well, every variable that you produce has to be defined in a continuous manner. It has to be measured in a continuous way. Right? Every variable that you use has to be continuous. It can't be discrete. Variables can't be categorical. They can't just be, you know, there's only three different categories. There actually has to be a continuous way of coding these things. So height and diameter, to use the examples from last time, work particularly well. Nationality doesn't work as well for a quantitative description. In fact, interval scales, which is scales in which the distance between any two points on the scale is the same, actually work better than ordinal scales, where the only thing you know is which one is more and which one is less. So if you can actually produce something that is an interval scale measure, then that actually helps a lot. So if you're dealing with dollar figures for gross domestic product or something. That's an interval scale because the distance between 1 and 2 is the same as the distance between 1 million and 1 million and 1. It doesn't shift around because, you know, a dollar's a dollar. And that is the kind of thing that you really are aiming for. That's like the gold standard of how you actually do this kind of quantitative work. You really want to try to define an interval scale whenever possible. There is also an interesting quantitative trick for how you can take a discrete measurement, or a variable that we usually measure discretely, something like gender, and turn that into something like a continuous variable. And the way a dummy variable works is you arbitrarily give one of the, imagine it's a variable that only has two categories, you know, imagine it's gender, imagine we're just doing male and female for a second. To turn that into a dummy variable, you would arbitrarily decide that male was 0 and female was 1. And then you would be able to plug it into your quantitative data set and your data collection that way. And the reason that's arbitrary is because female is not one more than male in any meaningful sense. There's no thing that's being measured there that somehow is present in one and not present in the other. Or a unit is present in one and not present in another. So this is a trick. This is a kind of quantitative trick. And you have to be very, very careful about using it. Because the more dummy variables you put into a quantitative study, the less reliable your results are going to end up being. So you want to use this kind of trick sparingly, if at all. And if it turns out that most of the variables that you're interested in are not actually continuous, you don't want to measure them continuously, you want to measure them discretely, you probably don't want to do a quantitative project, because it'll be very difficult to make the math work properly. The most important thing when you are doing quantitative measurement, just as when you are doing qualitative measurement, is consistency. How you arrive at the value of a variable has to be consistent from the beginning of your study all the way through the end. You can't suddenly turn on a dime and change in the middle of the study how you're counting something. The technique has to be constant. The data sources have to be constant the entire way through, because it is the consistency of that coding which actually lends the rigor to these kinds of studies. If not, if they don't have that consistency, then they end up not being good for very much. So they've got to be consistent the entire way through. And just as with the qualitative description, when you are doing quantitative description, theory remains absolutely central to what you're doing. Simply counting stuff is not a particularly good idea, because you need to know what to count, and you need to know what counts, for a particular measurement. You can't just go out and start, if you say you want to talk about how powerful a country is, you can't go out and just start counting tanks or counting planes or something. You need to actually have a theory that says, this is what I should be counting, and here's why. And this is how much qualifies. You know, if I'm going out there to count battalions in an army, what do I do with battalions that are in formation? How do I count those? Right? Why am I counting battalions? Why am I not just counting divisions? Why am I going down to a particular level? All of those are theoretical and conceptual questions, and those have to be answered before you start counting anything. Otherwise, if you just go out and start pointing your finger at stuff, you're going to end up with a whole lot of numbers that don't add up to much, and that's a problem. You need to have a theoretical justification for the variable. You need to be able to explain, suppose I'm trying to get at something like national power. Why is it important for me to know something about certain kinds of military units? Well, there has to be a justification for this in terms of the relationship between military capacity on the one hand and state strength on the other, right? Something along those lines, which has to come generally out of the literature that I'm reading. This is where your theoretical justifications come from. That is the kind of thing that you need. You must have that in order to justify why the variable is there in the first place. There's no justification, then there's no point in actually having the variable there in your study in the first place. And you have to be very careful, because numbers are seductive. Numbers kind of look true. Taking a set of figures, putting them in a table with some labels attached to them, kind of makes it look convincing, for reasons having to do with what you might call the epistemic authority of quantitative science. where we have learned over centuries, at least within the industrialized world, that there's something distinctive about numbers and about science based on numbers. So numbers kind of look true. They look more convincing. Think of those little graphs in the corner of USA Today. There are these little charts that are usually about fairly inane topics, but the fact that there's a chart there kind of makes it look like it's significant, makes it look like it means something. So be very skeptical. Be very skeptical about this. What makes a good study is not how many numbers it has. What makes a good study are questions of research design, how the study is put together, how the variables are justified, and then how accurately the counting is. But that only comes later in the process. It's those other kinds of more abstract conceptual questions which are really important with putting the study together and making the study work. In order to illustrate this, I want to talk about something that isn't exactly international politics. Well, it is kind of. It is kind of. Especially if you look at the composition of most Major League Baseball teams today. It's very much an internationalized enterprise. But I want to talk a little bit about baseball as a way of illustrating this point about how theory is implicated in various kinds of descriptions, even quantitative descriptions. And baseball, it turns out, is actually the perfect environment for doing quantitative measurement and quantitative description. There are three main reasons for this, three things about baseball that make it kind of sort of almost uniquely among major sports, uniquely quantifiable. So the first thing is that baseball is an effectively closed system. There are rules. The rules have remained relatively constant for a long period of time. There's a whole core of people, both umpires and central administrators, whose job it is to try to enforce the purity of the rules and keep them consistent over time. So you have a system, a social system, which is effectively closed because the rules are relatively constant. Also, the basic parameters of how the game is played are relatively constant. Ever since the last huge rule modification in baseball in the 19th century, where they changed the question of foul balls and whether foul balls actually counted as strikes or not. It was about the same time that they decided that catching a ball on one hop wasn't an out, and you actually had to catch the ball before it touched the ground at all. So once they changed those things, and once they put the pitcher's mound approximately where it was, that's been pretty constant ever since. So that kind of effective system closure, since there aren't other just random factors floating in and affecting the play of the game, that makes it a pretty good environment for counting stuff. It's also a very good environment for counting stuff because you get a lot of repetition. The same basic actions happen over and over again in the course of a baseball game. Person gets up to bat, puts bat on the shoulder, pitcher throws the ball, batter tries to hit the ball. Same basic things happening over and over again. The fact that they're happening over and over again, and because of the rules being relatively constant, they are the same over many, many years, it's easy to count them because they're pretty much the same. They're already being produced as similar, so you can just sort of count, oh, how many times did this guy come up and put a bat on his shoulder? Okay, so we can just kind of count that very easily. And then you have lots of acts, not just because they're repeated within games, but because there are a lot of games in a baseball season. Major League Baseball season has 162 games for each team during the regular season. That's a lot of games. You know, if you get up to bat three times, right, in terms of your position in the order, if you actually get to go up to bat three times and you play 162 games, right, that works out to about 480 times that you're at bat, approximately, over the course of a season. The numbers start to add up after a while. So it sort of makes sense because you've got a lot of stuff. You've got a big pool that you can draw from in terms of counting things. So that also makes it a very good environment for quantification. Clear definitions of these different acts are part of the activity itself. You don't have to make up this stuff. There are rules for what counts as what within baseball. They're much clearer than the rules within international politics for, say, what counts as a hostile incursion into someone else's territory, or what counts as a genocide, or things like that. Within baseball, it's pretty clear what counts as an out, what counts as a strike. All right, that, there's not an awful lot of ambiguity that's been introduced in that. So the activity itself tosses up these discreetly bounded acts, which is great, and it also tosses up a lot of them, which is even better. Then you can just count them up. Now, you might think in an environment like this that there wouldn't be much room for theory, but it turns out that theory is actually quite central to the way you count things, even in something as closed and restricted and repetitive as baseball is. In order to explain this, let me make sure we're all on the same page with the basic characteristics of how baseball works. The defense has the ball, makes it very unique among almost all major sports. Usually the offense has the ball, and the defense is trying to prevent the offense from doing something with the ball, getting it over the goalpost or putting it in the basket or whatever. Baseball's kind of odd because the defense has the ball, and the defense has to keep throwing it past the batter, right, who's the offense. They're trying to actually hit the ball. But the defense has the ball in baseball, which makes it kind of distinctive. The pitcher, therefore, stands up on the mound in the middle of the baseball diamond and keeps throwing the ball over and over, is absolutely crucial to the team's success. He's the primary defender, and he is absolutely critical. So there are a lot of statistics and a lot of ways of measuring performance for a pitcher, because pitchers are so crucial to the success of the team. Even if one knows nothing about baseball, one knows that three strikes and you're out. Right? That's become a cultural commonplace, which is globally circulated. The pitcher has to throw the ball, not just anywhere. They've got to throw the ball in a sort of narrow box, basically, next to the batter, over this home plate, which is 17 inches wide. And they have to throw the ball so that the ball goes between, is sort of higher than the batter's knees and lower than the midway between the batter's waist and the letters on the batter's uniform. So it's a very interesting little box that's kind of drawn in the air, and that's where the ball has to go. Ball goes through there, it's a strike. Batter hits it, it's a hit. Batter doesn't hit it, get called a strike. Three strikes, you're out. Four balls, which is to say four times where the ball doesn't pass through that strike zone and the batter doesn't swing at it, then you end up with a free pass. The batter gets to go to first base. This is called a walk. That's actually fairly important because there's actually quite a bit of theoretical controversy about who is responsible for a walk. Is it the pitcher messed up by not being able to throw the ball properly, or the batter did a really good job watching and taking a close pitch, which is to say not swinging at something that looked like it was right on the borderline and so wasn't quite a strike. So does the pitcher get blamed or does the batter get praised? That actually works out very interestingly in terms of how this is measured, as we'll see. And, of course, with baseball, you score runs by making your way all the way around the bases. Whether you do that by hitting a home run and doing all the bases at once, or base hit, get yourself on first base, and then you can sort of advance, you can steal bases. The point is that you score runs by making it all the way around first base, second base, third base, all the way around the diamond, and then coming back and touching home plate. Right? So that's basically how you score runs in baseball. And that's significant, because that puts a premium on certain kinds of skills and on certain kinds of aptitudes. All right, so that is an essential thing to keep in mind here. Now, there are a series of official statistics that are built into baseball itself ever since the game was invented. People have been counting up and trying to quantify various aspects of it. So it used to be the case that sort of the only statistics you could find about the performance of players, right, were very particular old statistics that had been around almost since the dawn of baseball back in the 19th century. For pitchers, your primary statistics were you had what's called the one-loss record, winning or losing. So the pitcher would get credited with a win if they were the pitcher at the time that their team went ahead in the score, and if they stayed ahead for the entire rest of the game, There's a couple more ambiguities about how long you have to pitch and things like that, but that's the basic idea, that the pitcher could win the game if their team stayed ahead in the score. The pitcher could lose the game if they were the pitcher and their team fell behind. In other words, if the other team went ahead. The theory here is it's the pitcher's fault if the other team goes ahead because the other team is scoring runs. The pitcher's job is to stop them from scoring runs by trying to strike them out or try to throw balls that they can't actually do much with, and so they end up hitting a weak grounder to second base or something, and then they get put out. Right? So that's the thing built into this notion of a one-loss record. The other statistic for a pitcher is what's called the ERA, or the earned run average. And an ERA, very simply, is how many runs were scored against the pitcher, but it's the number is equalized out as if they'd pitched a nine-inning game. So if you only pitched for three innings and one run scored against you, your ERA for that game is actually three, not one, because they take those three innings and they kind of stretch them out to nine. And then they take that one run, they sort of stretch it out to three. So ERA is how many runs would have been scored against you if you'd pitched that way for the entire nine-inning game. Right? That's the way that that particular statistic is calculated. And again, part of the idea there was that if you didn't pitch all nine innings, there was something wrong with you. You had gotten knocked out, you weren't strong enough, whatever. Or you had just fallen so far behind that they pulled you out, and you get penalized for having been pulled out after lots of runs have scored. Because if you've only been in for like two innings and a bunch of runs scored against you, you don't have the rest of the game to work that out. You get pulled out because you've done such a bad job. The ERA punishes you as a statistic because it loads on all the rest of the runs that hypothetically would have been scored against you if you'd kept pitching that way for the entire game. All right. Similarly, there are official statistics for hitters that have a kind of theory built into them. So there's the batting average. Right, how many times you were able to actually hit safely. That's basically how batting average is calculated. But batting average is very odd because batting average only takes account of times that you actually hit the ball. So if you get a walk, that doesn't count in your batting average, which is sort of interesting. And the other thing is what's called the RBI, or how many times there were people on base that you hit and the run was able to score. So the idea is that the hitter is responsible for hitting the ball in such a way as to allow other people to score. So responsibility is apportioned in very interesting ways with these statistics. Now, there are new statistics that people have come up with for hitters, which embody a very different kind of theory about what it means to do hitting in baseball. One of the new interesting statistics is one called OPS, which is a sum of these two other statistics, on-base percentage and slugging percentage. The on-base percentage is a statistic which basically rewards the hitter for the number of times that they manage to make it to first base. And it calculates this as a percentage of what's called plate appearance, which is to say the number of times they actually come up to bat. And that's important because batting average didn't include walks, because batting average, the whole metaphysics, the whole theory behind this is that a walk is the pitcher's fault, not something the batter actually did. In recent years, people have begun to think, you know, actually, a walk is something that a really good batter can actually produce because they hold off on these close pitches. They make the pitcher throw strikes, and if the pitcher can't throw strikes, very few pitchers are going to sit up there and every single pitch that they throw is actually going to be in the strike zone. It's just almost impossible to do in terms of the amount of control that's necessary. So a good patient hitter is able to force the pitcher to make mistakes. And talking about this in terms of on-base percentage rewards the batter rather than just penalizing the pitcher. And slugging percentage, that's the total number of bases divided by the times that you actually are at bat. Right? And the reason why that slugging percentage is a replacement in some ways for that, or an equivalent in some ways of that runs batted in statistic, is because batting average didn't involve how far you were able to hit the ball, or what was able to happen when you did it, right? Did you hit the ball and then you managed to hit it so far that you could run all the way to second base or third base? Slugging percentage rewards the batter more for hitting the ball further, in a sense. And a great slugger, someone like Lou Gehrig, who is pictured here, he's the one on the right, in case you were curious, was not just a wonderful hitter with a high average, he's also an incredible slugger. You know, would hit doubles and triples and such, and under this new system, this new statistical system, he would be more rewarded for that, because the idea is that if you hit more, if you hit harder and you can get on base more, then those things are going to add up to being able to score more runs, right? So that's the whole theory that lurks behind this. So the basic idea here is that if you can get on base more often, then it gives you more opportunities to score, so we should reward hitters for getting on base more often. Walks, in that sense, are just as valuable as hits. It's just as important to get a walk, because the important thing is getting to base. All right, so it's a shift in the whole strategy of the way people are playing baseball now. And a walk, as I said, can be worked. A walk can actually be produced by things that the hitter does. It can be produced proactively. And slugging percentage, right? If you think about it, if somebody's on first base and you hit a ball that goes far enough out that you can actually make it to second base, a really fast runner can score all the way from first. And if not that, they can certainly make it to third, which makes it a lot easier for the next guy to get them in. So hitting the ball a lot, hitting the ball very far, can actually produce more runs, people have discovered. So hitting the ball harder is better. The slugging percentage statistic actually rewards you for that. So this is a whole different theory of how to play baseball, a whole different strategy of how to play baseball. It's built into these quantitative measurements. Same thing happens over on the pitching side, where now people will talk not just about the ERA, but they'll talk about a whip, which is to say, not the thing Indiana Jones carries that makes a cracking noise, but instead the WHIP is an acronym. It means walks and hits per innings pitched. So how many walks and how many hits did a pitcher give up in an inning that they actually pitched? It's not equalized or normalized out to, you know, if they pitched a 9-inning game. It's just the exact number that they actually did it. And what WHIP rewards is it rewards efficiency and accuracy. How much control does the pitcher have? How few walks can they give out? How quickly can they dispense with various batters? Right. So WHIP is a different kind of measurement. It measures a different aspect of pitching, as it were. There's also the strikeouts per inning pitched. How many times are you able to strike somebody out? The theory here being that if you can just keep throwing the ball past guys and they can't hit it, then obviously they're not going to score very much. Strikeouts per walk, the strikeout to walk ratio, is another measure that people have proposed for how accurate a pitcher is. How many times are they striking people out versus how many walks are they issuing? Obviously you want that ratio to be high. You want 2-1, 3-1. Some pitchers are really ridiculous, and they'll do these, and they'll go out there, and over the course of several games, they'll be throwing like an 8-1 strikeout-to-walk ratio, which just means they're just striking everybody out, and they're not giving any free passes. It makes them a very accurate pitcher. And again, is a different way of measuring how their performance works. This rewards throwing strikes, right? All of these strike statistics reward throwing strikes rather than getting outs, which is interesting. Right? Rewards strikes rather than outs. The idea being you can measure people's performance a little bit differently by doing things like that. There are, of course, even funkier things floating around out there. There's a whole way of measuring pitchers which is called DIPS, which means defense-independent pitching statistics. It's this idea that the only thing the pitcher has control over is whether they give up home runs, whether they issue walks, or whether they throw strikes. So it's a very complicated way of calculating those three things. The idea behind this is that the pitcher basically has no control over where the ball goes, so if you manage to get the bat on it, then where it goes has nothing to do with the pitcher, it has to do with the defense, the rest of the defensive players on the team at that point, so that shouldn't actually count against the pitcher. This is still a kind of emerging theory, and so the math is still very, very complicated for thinking about DIPS. Another kind of statistic is what's called ERV scoring, which is where you take the baseball diamond and you see who's on what base at a particular point in time, and then you look all across the league and you see how many runs did the average team score when the players were aligned in that kind of format over time, over the last 2 or 3 years or something, and you can sort of calculate it based on the expectation. So it's this very different way of thinking about this by explicitly comparing every moment in a baseball game to similar moments across lots of baseball games. which you can do because you've got 162 games being played every season by 30 teams under a set of rules that's pretty constant from year to year. You've got a big set to draw from to produce something like this. There's also this interesting kind of analysis called VORP, which is the value over replacement player. And the idea here is that when you're playing baseball, if you're managing a team, you're not only putting talent on the field, you're also paying them. So people have calculated what the average replacement player would be able to generate in terms of statistics at a position and how much they would cost according to league rules about minimum salaries and so on. And then you see how much you're paying your particular star player and you see what's their value, how much are they giving you for that amount that you're paying them more than the average replacement value, how much it would cost to replace them. So here's my star second baseman. Here's what an average second baseman would do at this position. How much am I paying for the additional performance that my second baseman is giving me? What's this person's VORP? What's this person's value over a possible replacement player? Again, very different theory built in there, because the theory behind that kind of measurement is that a player's value is not just in their performance, but a player's value is tied up with their salary. Right, so it's a different way of thinking about it. And part of the reason I have this particular picture up here, it's a group of guys who came out to a game that the old stadium where the Nationals used to play, the RFK Stadium, and they came out to a game where the San Francisco Giants were in town wearing their asterisk shirts because they wanted to mock Barry Bonds, who was a slugger for the San Francisco Giants, implicated in all manner of steroid usage. So I put that in there to remind us that even within baseball, these kinds of statistics that are able to be generated don't always tell us the whole story. They simply measure performance. They don't necessarily explain why that performance occurred. Right? So this is all still at the descriptive level. We have to kind of remember that there's part of the story that may be missing when we're dealing with descriptive statistics. Punchline for this little digression about baseball that I've been on. Quantitative measurements express theories just the same way that qualitative measurements express theories about what's important. They isolate things, there's a theory built into them. A conception, a way of thinking about the world is built into even a seemingly exact quantitative measurement. Official statistics, official data that's collected, may not be as revealing about what's going on as things that you yourself design. That applies to baseball. That might also apply to things like poverty. That might apply to things like conflict, right? Officially collected sources of quantitative information may not be particularly revealing. You may need to design or think about designing your own technique for gathering and evaluating quantitative data. So, you know, you are allowed to do this. In fact, you are encouraged to do this if there is a good reason, a good justification for doing so. And of course, the final punchline is that if you are actually something of a stat head and you are very much interested in calculating lots of interesting quantitative work, baseball may be the ideal sport for you in a way that other things like, say, American football might not be, because there just aren't enough games and the numbers don't mean quite as much. Baseball, large numbers of repeated acts, so it's a very, very good place to run various sorts of statistics. Now, one thing that I want to call attention to is that all the stuff we've been talking about so far have involved the idea that you could basically gather the entire population of cases and take quantitative measures of them. Right, you're looking at all of the cases within a particular group, all the players within baseball or something like that. You're gathering data about each member of the population individually, but you've got all of the members available to you. The units, when you're doing something like this, are cases. Right? So if you're counting up how well someone has done fielding, how well they've done catching and throwing the ball or something within baseball, or if we go back into politics for a second, if we're counting how people voted on things, then each unit, each person would be a case within this. You have a whole universe of cases, a population that you're actually trying to measure. And the description of the population as a whole, if you're doing this kind of work, is just an aggregate of all the different individual descriptions. So you count up what happens to each individual person, and then you sort of put them together. And you can do that much more easily when you have quantitative data, because then you can just sum it. You can add things together. You can take averages. You can do things that you couldn't ordinarily do or couldn't do if you didn't have quantitative data. This is often technically challenging to do, but it can be done. What's also technically challenging sometimes is actually gathering data about each member of the population, particularly if the population gets really big. You know, millions and millions of people, real hard to talk to all of them. So there are some techniques to work around that, but they're all ways of approximating sort of this whole population analysis, which is kind of what you're trying to get at when you do quantitative work. Now, if you have a bunch of data about different populations, there's different ways in which you can use them. One of the more interesting, or some more standard things, actually, that people do when they have a bunch of quantitative data about a population is they're interested in usually knowing sort of where the middle of that data is. But there's three different kinds of that. So if you talk about taking the average across a whole bunch of cases, right, there's the different kinds of middle, and we've got to be real clear about this. Right? Usually when we say we want to take the midpoint, we are talking about the mean, the numerical average of a group of data points. So I gathered up a whole bunch of information about like the GDPs of different countries, and I want to find the average GDP, the mean GDP. So I just add them all up and then divide by the number of cases. Very simple arithmetic calculation. So that's the numerical average. That would be the mean. But sometimes you also want to know other things about a group of quantitative data. Sometimes you want to know the median, which is to say the middle point, 50% higher, 50% lower. Now that may not always be the same thing as the arithmetic average or the mean. The median might actually be different. Why might the median be different? Well, because imagine that you've got a situation where you have 30 data points to be talking about people's incomes, but the bottom 15 of them make less than, all of them together make less than number 17, right? So the median would be 50% of the points higher, 50% lower. The median would be there, would cut up the population, so you have those 15 poor and those 15 rich, except the 15 rich are way rich and the 15 poor are very poor, so the average might actually be somewhat higher than the median. Right? So you got to be real careful which kind of middle you're doing. There's also another middle called a mode, which is just the most common data point. Almost nobody uses this. I just toss it in there because you'll often see in statistics textbooks people talking about means, medians, and modes, and so I'll just mention that it's there. But that one is actually the least useful kind of middle. So, in fact, usually the most useful one is going to be the mean, but the 50th percentile mark, the median, has certain functions as well. Particularly if we're trying to talk about this question of not just where is the average, but where is the middle, but how spread out is the data across the population that you're trying to get at. Now, one thing you can do is you can divide the population up into what's called quartiles, which is to say looking for these very significant points in the data. And we all know about this because we all took the SAT, right? We're all taking percentile tests, so you all, or tests where you get your score back and you get a percentile rating, which is like how you did compared to the rest of the population, where you fell in percentage terms. And so one way you can analyze how spread out the data is by dividing it up into 25, 50, 75 percentage points and then seeing like how many things fall within there. But that's an odd way to do it sometimes because that's going to be specific to an individual case, specific to an individual set of data. So statisticians have devised something called a standard deviation, which you can use across data sets. It tells you how spread out a group of numbers are around their average, around their mean. So if everybody's kind of close to the middle, then you're going to have a much lower standard deviation. If everybody's very spread out, then you're going to have a much higher standard deviation. These actually turn out to be very easy to calculate, not by hand. It can get kind of complicated by hand, but with any kind of spreadsheet program, you can calculate this stuff very easily. So here's a quick example. This is actually drawn from a previous time that I taught this class where I asked people, went around the room and asked people their age and their height, and went ahead and calculated that. And then when you plop that into a spreadsheet, you can end up very quickly calculating these means and things down at the bottom. So you can see here, right, you can see that the mean in both of these cases is higher than the median point, which means that there were more older people and more taller people in the class, right? Because this means everything is skewed toward the high end a little bit. And as you can see with the 50th and 75th percentile, those are just the break points within the data, right? You can see how far apart they are, or how lack of far apart they are. Look at the bottom of the age column for a second. You see there, you see 25th percentile and 50th percentile. See that the distance between the 25th and the 50th is only 0.5. It's 20 and 20.5. That tells me that a lot of the class is actually clustered between 25th and 50. Right, that there's a lot of people in there, because that's a very, very small, it's a very small amount, right? It means that a large proportion of the large number of the points of data that we have are kind of clustered around that particular point. If you look at the standard deviation, well, standard deviation says clearly that there's much more variation in age than there is in height. People's height doesn't vary by all that much, but people's age varies by a little bit more. Right. So these are just summary statistics, basic ways of talking a little bit about what those quantitative columns actually mean, going from individual data point measurements on people to whole population measurements on an entire class. On Monday, we may actually do this for our class, just to sort of see what we get in terms of comparative ratios and such. Now, if you don't have the whole population actually sitting in front of you that you can ask them questions, there's another technique that can be used, which is called sampling. And the way a sampling technique works is you make a random sample from the population. As long as you're randomly choosing cases, then you can draw conclusions about the larger population. So if you're doing a telephone survey to try to find out people's political preferences, you do not have to talk to everybody. You only have to talk to a certain number. It's a much smaller number than several million. You can actually generalize to most of the United States, or something about the size of the United States, with somewhere around 3,000 respondents, as long as they're all randomly selected. Random selection is the important thing. It's got to really be random. The sample cannot simply consist of people who are unified on certain characteristics. If it is, it's going to throw everything off. So the sample has to be a really random sample. It turns out to be very difficult to have a really random sample, because there's all kinds of ways that even just grabbing people off the street corner at a particular time of day, you might end up producing not a random sample, but a group of people who have a certain reason to be there at a particular point in time, and therefore actually similar on some crucial or critical respect. So you gotta be very careful about things like that. But a small sample, if done right, can generalize quite a lot, and that can actually save you quite a bit of time and effort. This is often logistically easier, but it does introduce some error, a little margin for error. So if you look at those poll information that always gets cited on some of the national networks, they'll always talk about it being plus or minus 3% error. So because there's a margin of ambiguity built into those kinds of sampling and generalization procedures, which if you have the whole population, you don't have to worry about that, because if you have the whole population, then you've got the whole population. You don't have to worry about generalizing, because you've got everybody to start off with. And of course, I know this is getting a little long, but I'm winding down here. The whole idea of these kinds of collections of data is that you can compare. You can compare across these particular cases. You can compare cases easily to one another. And the main reason you do this when you're engaged in especially quantitative description is to evaluate what are called associative hypotheses, which is to say guesses about how things are connected to each other. So associative means there's a systematic connection between variable attributes. So are age and height always systematically connected? Right? Are older people always taller? Right? So that would be an associative question. And a hypothesis might be, well, sure, because as you grow in age, then you also grow in height. And there are various ways in which you could disprove that hypothesis by going out and pointing out that people are not, in fact, 12 feet tall by the time they're 60. So there's ways of gathering data that could disprove this particular hypothesis, which brings us to the other word, to the word hypothesis. Hypothesis means guess. So when you are actually talking about an associative hypothesis, you mean a guess about how particular variables are connected to each other across cases, how these things are actually systematically linked. So economic growth and democracy, right? Are they systematically linked across cases? You could have a hypothesis about that. That would be an associative hypothesis. And the way you would evaluate that is by gathering data on multiple cases and checking to see whether or not it was true, whether that association held. The main thing you've got to do here is you've got to distinguish between systematic and accidental associations. Is the connection between these variables something that is true in general, or is it just something that is true once or twice? Because, as statisticians would always tell you, anything can happen once, given enough instances. You know, flip a coin enough times, and eventually you're going to get a run of 1,000 heads in a row. Now, you might have to flip the coin for longer than the age of the known universe, but if you kept doing it long enough, according to the rules of probability, there would come a time where you would get 1,000 heads in a row. It may not be real likely, but anything can happen once as long as you have enough repetitions. Case comparison is not about what happens once, but about what happens repeatedly or reliably across time and space. How do you go from some association obtaining within a couple of cases to saying, no, this is an association that obtains all the time in all kinds of cases? That is the interesting trick. That is where a lot of this dualist descriptive work actually trends. This is what it moves toward, is doing this kind of comparison to get systematic association across cases. That's kind of what we're driving toward with all of this. And as a final thing, I want to talk a little bit about what it is that should be in your dualist proposal. I will talk a little bit about this at the end of the next lecture as well, after we introduce causation, which we've sort of built up to now. But when you're doing a dualist proposal, if you want to get a head start on it, there are basically four things that you need. The first thing you need is a research question, because as I said at the outset of the course, if you don't have a research question, you don't actually have a research paper. So you need a research question. What is something, sort of descriptive, or how do cases compare in some category, right? How do these things compare if we're talking about some particular variable? That's a valid descriptive research question. There's another one for causation, which I'll add in on next lecture. The second part of a dualist proposal is your initial guess. How do you think this stuff is going to work out? You have to have a guess. It doesn't have to be right. It just has to be a guess. And then you're going to go out and gather data and see whether or not you were correct. The third thing you need in a dualist proposal, and this is where the bulk of your work is going to be, is talking about your variables. So how do you define them? What's the justification for them? How are you going to measure them? Basically doing that exercise that we did in class on Wednesday, where we took each variable and asked those three questions about it. Basically, you're going to need to give me that information, right? How do these variables actually play out, right? How are you defining it? How are you going to measure it? That's an important thing that I need to know. And the fourth thing is you got to talk a little bit about where you're going to get the data. I'm not actually asking you, because this is just a proposal, I'm not actually asking you to go out and measure anything, but I am asking you to tell me a little bit about how you would. What would you consult? What kind of data would you need in order to actually implement this project, in order to actually operationalize this, in order to actually start measuring cases on these particular variables? What would your data sources be? What would you do? And that's going to require you thinking a little bit about where you would get the appropriate kind of information to engage in this kind of measurement process to measure those variables. And that, slightly longer than I promised this would be, but there was a lot of material here, that should do it for thinking a little bit about quantitative description.